Support for WPR comes from Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona with Once Upon a Shore, literary works by authors, illustrators, and artists of Native nations. On view now, mmam.org.
You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nadeau. Erin Presley is back with us. She is a horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, where she cares for the herb, wildflower, and pond gardens. Erin's gardening interests include native woodland gardening, low maintenance and sustainable gardens, and anything having to do with growing, cooking, and eating your own herbs and vegetables. So what gardening questions do you have for her? She can answer pretty much anything you throw at her, maybe. She's raising her eyebrows at me. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Erin, thanks so much for being back with us.
Hi, Jill. Thanks for having me today, and happy first frost here in Madison.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I'm happy about that, but, you know, it had to come and, you know, whatever. But it's sunny out, so that's good.
Yeah,
that's
beautiful, good. Crisp fall day out there.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
Just gorgeous.
It really is. It really is fall. So what's going on at Olbrich right now?
Well, we just always have, you know, something great to look at out in the gardens. So our fall color is just beautiful on the trees. In the woodland garden, we have some really soft buttery yellows with some of our sugar maples and hickories. And along the long walk near our visitor center, we have just these blazing red musselwood trees that
are
beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the perennials have really great fall color. And, you know, we do garden for multi-season interests. So although some of the really, you know, kind of brightly colored annuals may have bit the dust last night, we always have great, great multi-season interest and lots to see, lots of late blooming perennials still out there. So
sure.
Always a great time to visit.
I always like to think of it as going to the big compost bin in the sky, right?
Yes, and we do actually also operate a very active compost pile. And so all of the plant material that comes out of the gardens, we hot compost it, and then we turn that compost that's produced into potting soil for all of our container displays for
sure.
The next year. So
that's a huge savings for you.
Oh, my gosh, because the potting soil is quite expensive,
yeah.
And we're avoiding the usage of peat, which sometimes is a controversial topic about the harvesting of peat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really been a great addition to our, you know, sustainability focus in the garden the past couple of years.
For sure. So Gleam is still going on, isn't it? Or was that over last weekend?
It is the last few nights of Gleam.
Okay.
So we had just overwhelmingly positive response to our Gleam Art in a New Light outdoor light show this year. It's a great way to support the gardens and enjoy the garden in the evening. It is a timed and ticketed event, so if you are still interested in making one of the last viewings, hop online and reserve your tickets, because it does usually, many of the nights in October sell out.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very popular event, and this year we had artists that we're flying in from Japan. We had exhibitors from Australia, as well as local people, too.
Sure.
So it's really kind of becoming quite the international affair.
I've heard great things. Larry and our producer, Clara Neipert, went on a little trip a couple weekends ago, and they did a little short video. So if anybody wants to see it and some of the cool highlights, it's on our social media, Instagram and Facebook. Just look for WPR, and you will find it there. So that was kind of fun, too. What else? Now, you were mentioning that you all have some long-term plans that you're looking at for the gardens.
Yes. So Olbrich is really thrilled that we are embarking on a new comprehensive plan. So this is basically a strategic plan that involves a lot of both staff and community input about where we would like to see the garden go physically and strategically in the next, you know, realistically, probably 20 to 25 years, because that scale of change takes a long time.
It takes
and
a long time.
Cooperation and money to make big changes happen. So we're looking at possible garden expansion, you know, if we have new spaces What do we want them to look like? What are the messages we want to, you know, portray there? Everything from funding and staffing to down to little details. How do we, you know, increase our education and recreation opportunities? So we want everybody to be involved. So there will be opportunities in the coming months for public listening sessions. There will be ways to submit feedback online as well. So really, if you have a great idea for something that you think, you know, public gardening should reflect here in Wisconsin, we would love to hear it and incorporate as many of those great ideas as we can into our future.
And you have a really nice website where people could get information about these things. And if you're a member, you get a quarterly, isn't it? Quarterly, little like a magazine.
Yes.
Type of thing?
So members do get a quarterly newsletter. And we're just, you know, obviously when you have a plan of this scale, you work with partners that are all really located both regionally and across the United States. So we're working with a large planning firm that has offices in many U.S. cities. But then we have local partners that are, you know, looking at everything from engineering and architecture, landscape architecture, equity and diversity, and making sure that we really craft a good plan that will serve everybody's needs going forward. So mm-hmm. we're just at the tip of the iceberg right now. So we don't really quite have our, you know, public forums set up just
sure.
yet,
mm-hmm.
but keep an eye out for that in the coming months. And, you know, even just keep an eye on the Olbrich website, and
yeah.
there'll be lots of opportunities to have everybody's voices be heard.
Yeah, for sure. And you got your Christmas stuff coming up soon, your holiday trains, right?
Is that yes?
Yeah.
We also we'll be setting up shortly for during the month of December. We run in partnership with a local train club, a holiday train show indoors. And so this year the theme is a snowy storybook.
Ooh,
and so we'll be creating
cute.
All of these wintry scenes and lots of white poinsettias, white, you know, other wintry flowers, and then recreating scenes from, you know, familiar stories that have winter themes that you might be familiar with.
Sure. Well, that sounds like fun. And is that a fundraiser for the gardens also?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. For members, usually admission to any of our special events like that is always free or
mm-hmm.
Very much reduced. And then for the general public, nothing I feel like at Olbrich is really ever too expensive.
No,
so,
it isn't at
you know,
all.
I think it's maybe $6 or $8
sure.
For the train show. And
mm-hmm.
we do have a strong avenue for access admission. And so if you ever are in a position where you have a financial need, it's very easy to arrange for those free admissions so that really everybody can get in and
yes.
see what we all have to offer.
Yes, and it's wonderful. No matter when you visit, you always have a good time, even if it's just at the gift shop.
Yes, the gift shop is right inside the door, so
oh, yeah.
never any charge to enter the
no,
gift shop. That's
well,
for sure. Yeah.
If you're me, there's a charge because I always have to buy
Self-imposed
charge. I like that. Well, let's talk about Herb Fair, because that's another thing that's coming up at Olbrich. So.
Yeah, never a dull moment.
Yeah.
And we are so happy to be hosting again the Madison Herb Fair, which is hosted by the Madison Herb Society. And that is going to be coming up in just about a week on Saturday, November 1st. And it's from 10 to 4 at Olbrich Gardens. So here in Madison on the east side on Atwood Ave. And admission to the fair, as well as to the outdoor gardens, is completely free. So it's just a public drop-in event. And it's the best smelling day of the year at Olbrich, by far. And the Herb Society puts together a wonderful lineup of speakers. And then they also have a lot of really great vendors. I think I looked at the list and there was upwards of 20 vendors.
Yeah, I was really surprised.
It is neat. It's everything from, you know, body care, salves, creams, beverages, elixirs, I guess. You know, anything that you would need for immunity, especially now that we're going into cold season, everything that you would want to kind of stock your spice cabinet and your, you know, get ready for some winter meal planning. And then the theme this year is explosion of flavor. So the speakers, and we can go into those maybe a little bit more later, the individual speakers are all kind of talking about their own takes on, you know, herbs for health, but also really to tune into the wonder of everything herbs can do to kind of brighten up your, you know, brighten up your kitchen game and give you some new fun flavors to work with.
So very popular topics, including fermentation and mushrooms and garlic. And we'll get into those in just a little bit. We'll give you all the details on who's going to be doing them and what time, etc. Our guest today is Erin Presley. She's a horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. If you've got gardening questions for her, give us a call. They don't have to be just herb related. 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. I got a missive from Michelle Good over at Chapter A Day, and apparently they are celebrating the 20th anniversary of Marley and Me, Life and Love with the World's Worst Dog by John Grogan, and they want to hear from you. They'd like you to tell a story about your bad dog, and, you know, you might just hear it on Chapter A Day when Marley and Me's re-aired starting November 10th. So if you have a story, send an email to baddog@wpr.org. They're only going to take entries for a short time, so make sure to get yours in right away if you are interested. But right now we are talking about herbs, and Erin, you brought me some stuff.
Yes. So I wanted to, in keeping with the theme, explosion of flavor.
Yes.
I thought we would try a few things that you might not associate with, you know, just kind of your run-of-the-mill, everyday herb garden, which, of course, all of those things are great culinary staples. But part of our, you know, work at Olbrich is to expose people to some stuff that they're a little, you know, might be a little out of the box for them. And so I have for you over there some regular old roasted veggies and then a great sauce that is based on wakate. So wakate is a type of marigold that is used a lot in Peruvian cuisine. And so the marigold plants, they're Tagetes minuta, and they have these very fine feathery leaves. And the plants themselves, they don't have much for a flower, kind of a creamy green, not real exciting looking flower. But the leaves have this amazing kind of like a pungent, but sort of yet bright, like a little bit of mintiness in there. Just the most unique flavor that you can use to incorporate into sauces. And so I paired that along with another Peruvian, actually, chili pepper, aji peppers, which are interesting because they're some of the oldest peppers that were known to be domesticated by humans.
Wow.
So there's evidence of actually this species of pepper that shows up where, you know, people were saving and collecting seeds in Peru like 10,000 plus years ago. And so you combine those chilies and the marigold and kind of smooth it all out in an aioli and then use that as a dipping sauce for veggies or, you know, steak or something like that if you're into that.
It's really good. I'm eating this right now and, okay, I'm like, marigolds. Okay, all right, let's try this. You do, you know how marigolds smell? You get the taste, and it's not a bad thing at all, because I do not like the smell of marigolds, but the taste is there, and then when you finish it off, you get that zing of the pepper, and it is really good, but it's not too zingy at all, but you can still feel it. It's like happiness on your taste buds.
Yeah, the aji peppers I really like, too, if you ever see them at the farmer's market or you want to grow them at home. They're really neat because they are actually a different species of pepper than many of our other culinary peppers. They're Capsicum baccatum, which is in contrast to many of the other peppers we're used to, our Capsicum annuum. And then they also have a kind of a citrusy flavor, and then the heat of them is kind of on the front end, so they're a little spicy right when you eat it, but it's not like a heat that lingers in your mouth
right.
or, you know, has you pounding sour cream for 10 minutes, you know, into the future.
I know. I love that tang, but you're right, you know, and your taste buds die and, you know, you can't taste anything after that. And so, yeah, we don't want to do that. But no, that was very, very tasty. So thank you. And you also brought me some tea.
Yes. And this is a great herbal tea that I learned to make when I was working with Sabrina Herr with some of the community connections we were making with the Hmong Garden at Olbrich. And as a part of the Hmong Garden, and ever since then, honestly, we always grow ginger and turmeric because they provide, as ornamental plants, really awesome tropical-looking kind of flair, really
okay.
broad leaves and really neat-looking ornamental characteristics. And then if we have, you know, a hot and wet summer like we did this past summer, the ginger and turmeric actually can be very productive. So this is a tea that has ginger and turmeric. I've made it before, and Sabrina taught me to make it with lemongrass, which I did not have in my kitchen today. But then you add a little bit of honey and lemon juice to sort of brighten up and bring the flavors all together.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a great tea for ginger and turmeric are both really great for any type of inflammation. Ginger is great for nausea or upset stomach. Both of them have that kind of sort of peppery, pungent, aromatic nature that's really great for even just kind of waking you up if you need a little bit of a pick-me-up. Yeah, and it just has a really beautiful, sunny, golden color that's great for kind of mirroring the beautiful fall day we have out there.
You know, absolutely, and you gave it to me. There's a lovely little teacup, too. yeah, that's really, really good. Now, do you have to have fresh ginger and fresh turmeric?
It really works the best if you do have fresh ginger and fresh turmeric.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find those in your local grocery store, they freeze really well. So, and a little kind of goes a long way.
Yeah.
So, you know, I sometimes even will, you know, freeze little ice cube trays or something that have a little bit of minced ginger and turmeric that's ready to go. And then you're able to just, you know, pop one of those cubes into some boiling water and have your tea kind of ready for you pretty conveniently.
I freeze my ginger all the time and it grates really well when it's frozen.
Yeah, it can be a little easier to work with too.
Yeah, I like it really well. Well, before we talk about the guests for the herb fair, we do have a question from Dave in Verona. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a first-time rose gardener, and I'm wondering what I should do to prepare my roses to overwinter, if you have any advice on that.
Great. Thanks, Dave. I was curious, do you know what are the types of roses that you're growing? Are these like a landscape or a shrub rose, like kind of a hardier rose, or are these more of a miniature or, you know, a hybrid tea rose? Do you have a feeling for what you got there?
I think I have one, what they call knockout rose, and the other two are not knockout roses, but they're right now, they're probably about 3 foot high, three and a half foot high. That's all I can tell you.
Sure. No, that's good info. So the knockout rose particularly, and I'm assuming if you bought them at the same time or at, you know, the same type of garden center, what you probably all have are fairly robust roses that we would call a landscape rose or a shrub rose. So they're quite a bit less fussy than some of the other types of roses out there. So you made good decisions. And the knockout rose especially was bred by a wonderful Wisconsin plants person, Will Radler, who lives in Milwaukee. So very regionally suited as well. So what you're going to want to do is almost nothing. In our
<Yes.
laughs> tower garden, where we grow most of our roses at Olbrich, any of those hardy shrub roses like that, we really don't do a thing with them going into the winter. One thing you might consider is if any of the branches are really long and whippy or near like a sidewalk or something, where if you're going to get a snow load on it, it's going to break off or, you know, kind of flop over onto your sidewalk, you could consider doing a very small amount of pruning just to reduce the size and make it a little bit more compact. But many of these roses, they've been bred for hardiness. So if we have a mild winter, you may find new growth next spring that is covering a good proportion of the plant. And then at that point, you can choose, you know, how much you want to reduce the size for your needs for the coming year. If we have a really difficult winter, you might notice that the roses die back almost all the way to the ground. And then the new sprouts that you see next year will be coming from, you know, within just 4 or 5 inches from the soil line. But by leaving the rose intact going into the winter, you kind of keep the potential of all of that tissue to stay alive and kind of help, you know, even collect and hold snow, having a little bit more of a structure there that can catch on to the snow and keep it from blowing away will help insulate your plant. So for the types of roses that it sounds like you have, you don't really have to do anything going into the winter right now.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Dave. So we did get an email from Colleen in Cumberland, and she is a no-till gardener, and she is wondering what she should be doing this fall. More cover? Wait till spring? What is the procedure?
Yeah. So if you are looking at no-till gardening, which, you know, more and more, whether you're a home or hobbyist gardener, or you're working on larger and larger scales of vegetable farms, or even a lot of, you know, crop farmers are more and more utilizing no-till technology. Especially one thing that we're looking at in Wisconsin, we don't always get that reliable snow cover like we used to. And so if we have freezing and thawing or like winter rain events, and you have soil that's been recently tilled and is loose, that winter rain can just actually start, you know, sweeping your soil away, especially on a large scale or in, you know, a farm type situation. So as much as you can, if you can just find some way to cover the soil over the winter is great. Mulch works great. You know, depending on what you're growing, you could consider a thin-ish layer of wood chip mulch, leaves of any kind. You know, one thing that is really important this time of year is to hold on to and capture those leaves that are falling off your property as much as you can. So whole or lightly chopped leaves can work well. You could also investigate some cover cropping. And at least in Madison, it's getting a little bit late to sow a lot of cover crops. But if you look, actually, the UW Extension fact sheets has a whole fact sheet that's all about, and for those of you who might not be familiar, cover cropping is the practice of growing a crop that is grown by seed on a piece of your garden that is not actually something that you're going to harvest, but it has a role in insulating or building soil. It keeps weeds away because it, you know, reduces the opportunity for weed seeds to creep in and germinate on bare soil, can reduce erosion. So you might be able to find a cover crop seed if you checked out one of those UW Extension fact sheets. There's one that I believe is cover crops for the home gardener, and you can probably find something that you might be able to sow yet this fall, especially if the weather holds and we get a little bit more warm weather yet.
And it's basically green fertilizer because you just work it in next spring, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And some of the cover crops would overwinter and then they would start growing again next spring. And then you would actually be, you know, extending that time frame where you have kind of a buffer and can choose when to terminate or kill off your cover crop. Other cover crops are designed to, you know, die at the first frost. So if you had sown them in July, frost would kill it and leave you kind of a bare slate for next spring. So there's really a lot of cover crops. As I'm not by no means savvy, but it's definitely something I'm really interested in and have done some really, also really pretty work in the garden with cover crops while building soil too.
Well, we've heard quite a bit about that in the last few years. It seems to be becoming a pretty popular option for a lot of people.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You also, if you look at a website for a good, you know, a good seed catalog like Johnny's Select Seed, or I know Territorial Seed out in Maine, they have large portions of their catalog or their website that are devoted to cover crops, and you can find a lot of good information about what would be suitable for your climate and timing and, you know, application rates and all that good stuff.
All the details.
Yep.
All the details. Well, thanks for the question, Colleen. Dave in Appleton has something for us. Go right ahead, Dave.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one is on sweet autumn clematis. Is that invasive and how do I control it? I heard you can cut it right down to the ground before the seeds, before it produces seeds. And but will that hurt the plant or will it be just as prolific next year?
Okay, so this question is about the sweet autumn clematis, Clematis paniculata, which I am not sure whether that is listed on our state invasive species list, but it is definitely considered invasive in many climates, and it is on, you know, at Olbrich, it is not a plant that we would ever plant.
yeah.
And it does have those beautiful, you know, the seeds when the flowers are finished are these beautiful, whispery, kind of spidery seed heads. So you can see why people like it. And that's why a lot of our invasive plants, you know, have success.
They look pretty.
People plant them and they spread around.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, definitely removing the potential of spreading by seed, by cutting the whole plant down and, you know, either disposing in your, you know, that might almost be something that you consider disposing like other invasive species in a trash bag and throw it in the landfill. Or if you do have like a hot compost or something like that where you can really get rid of those seeds. The plant next year is not going to be phased at all by you cutting it down right now. So, you know, if you're really serious about mitigating the risk of spreading this plant, you would be well advised to start thinking about digging that out next year. We do have, you know, many lovely other clematis varieties that are not invasive. And another one that is a native plant that's often suggested as a alternative for the sweet autumn clematis is a native Clematis virginiana. And that one is still quite vigorous, but it is, you know, a native plant. And so you're mitigating some of the risks of you know, doing ecological harm by having an invasive species around. But it mimics a lot of the same look of the sweet autumn clematis, especially with those really fuzzy, kind of silvery, wispy seed heads. So you can consider that as an alternative if you did want a similar plant.
Is that readily available in places where you can find native plants and seeds?
I would think so, because it's very easy to propagate. Like, okay, it shouldn't be hard to for growers, mm-hmm, to grow. Otherwise, I'm sure through mail order, it's a very, you know, pretty tough, vigorous plant. So it shouldn't be hard to get going once you have a little piece of it.
Our guest today is Erin Presley, and she's a horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. You have a gardening question for her, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. And speaking of emails and composting, Bill in Oregon emailed us. He knows to keep diseased plants and walnut leaves out of his compost pile, but has your research and experience revealed any annuals that should not be composted? Great question.
Oh, that is a good question. You know, not that I have particularly looked into. The only thing would be, you know, a lot of the annuals by this time of year are looking pretty sad and may have been affected by, you know, one disease or another.
Yeah.
I know we have some Verbena bonariensis, which is a really popular, very tall verbena at work, and that one is just covered with powdery mildew by this time of year. So that might be something you would consider keeping out of there. Beyond that, no, I can't say that I have ever really seen much as far as plants. Oh, actually, one to keep out of there, castor bean.
Oh, yes.
So the beans of the castor bean are very like poisonous and
very
and so that would be something to keep out of there, just even more from kind of like a safety perspective. The castor bean is a beautiful annual that's, you know, I just chopped some down yesterday that had to be 15 feet tall, and they have a beautiful palmate leaf. They're very showy in the garden. But that's one that if your plant does set seed, you would be well advised to pay attention to where those seeds land, and especially if you have a pet or kids running around or something like that. It does create these seeds that are, they look kind of like a big brown lima bean, I guess. And so that would be one, if those seeds are around, just pay real close attention to where they land and consider putting those in the trash.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you for that email, Bill. Let's go back to the phones, and we've got Dina in Madison. Go right ahead, Dina.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. So I have a question. We have a lot of giant rock walls in our yard, and I'm trying to figure out something that I can plant that will both help prevent erosion and also bonus points if it's really pretty. The rock is all kind of gray and white, and it can look a little bit drab, so I'm looking to add some pops of color, if at all possible.
Oh, this is a, such a great question. So as long as we're on the topic of herbs, I think that creeping thyme would be a great candidate for this. So the thyme plants, and you could start with just kind of the most basic mother of thyme is Thymus serpylum. So that's probably one of the most common varieties of thyme you'd find at a garden center. And then from there, you can branch out into so many other cool thymes. And they'll all have that same sort of aromatic nature, be useful in the kitchen, be useful for herbal cleaning. A lot of times have antiseptic properties that can be really great if you pair them with, you know, vinegar-based cleaners and things like that. Additionally, thyme has blooms. So it can bloom anywhere from like white to lavender to kind of magenta color. Very drought tolerant, and the blooms of really anything in the mint family like thyme are really great for insects of all kinds. So that would be a really fun and also functional plant that you could consider using. A lot of creeping sedums would work really well for what you're talking about. There's, you know, kind of an old classic favorite is the dragon's blood sedum, which is a creeping sedum that has a kind of this blood red small foliage. And then additionally, lots of our sedums have flowers that are pink, white, orange, you know, kind of you name
yellow.
It. Yeah, so you could mix and match sedums. There's some really great, for something that offers you a little bit more scale, you could consider adding in some draping grasses along the edge. So one of our native grasses, prairie dropseed, has a beautiful fountain-esque habit that could kind of, you know, soften that upper edge. There's some great drought-tolerant goldenrods that have a kind of that creeping habit like that. There's a really great one called Solar Cascade goldenrod that we use at work. That could kind of leap out of your wall. And so you really have, you have a lot of options. That's just kind of, you know, touching the tip of the iceberg there for you.
Yeah, for sure. And all those are absolutely beautiful. And with the grasses, the texture with the thyme would be really pretty. What about something like Irish moss, which isn't really a moss, but it's kind of looks like moss. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah. And actually, I guess I just assumed that these rock walls were in full sun,
right?
Which would be a much different ball game than if you did have shade, in which case like the Irish moss would work well. There's a really great plant that is called Kenilworth ivy. It's Cymbalaria, and it kind of, I hate to say it, but it kind of has a resemblance to the creeping Charlie that you would see in your yard, but it's a much more refined plant that kind of, you know, clings and creeps along the edges of walls like that. So I would say if you even went to like a good garden center and perused their kind of their ground cover section, you'll find a lot of those sort of creepy crawly little plants that'll work well for you.
Yeah, and have some fun, Dina, because that sounds like a great opportunity for doing a little gardening. And all those should come back for you, so you don't have to do them every year. So
yes, that's going to be, you know, anything. And I always figure plant, you know, a lot of those plants towards the upper edge of the wall. And then over time, as they are able to seed or kind of, you know, extend their runners downwards, they'll probably start to colonize the lower parts of the wall on their own just by putting gravity to work.
And it's always better to let them decide because they're probably going to do better.
Yes, right. They'll have their own ideas for
That's
plants for you.
Well, David Appleton called back. He's got 50 or more perennials that he just purchased in Summer Zone 5 and Summer Zone 4. What's the latest you can plant them?
Okay, you're really playing roulette over there,
Wow.
Dave. You know, the way this fall is going, I think you're going to have better success just trying to get those plants in the ground than doing some sort of, you know, overwintering setup in your basement or garage or whatever. The soil is still plenty warm. If anything, you'll just have to be attentive to watering. In many parts of Wisconsin, we are running pretty dry for where we are in the fall. And so your best bet is just going to be to get those in the ground. Even the zone five plants, you know, a lot of places in Wisconsin, our hardiness zones are changing. And so zone five type conditions is something that a lot of Wisconsin really is experiencing. So I would just get them in the ground, water them well a couple times. If you have some mulch that you're able to put over the top of them and provide some extra insulation for the winter, you'll have better chances of those, you know, overwintering. But the best place to you know, have them spend their winter is definitely in
the
soil.
Ground, yeah. Yep. And even if they're not in the spot where he wants them, as long as he gets them in the ground, he can always move them later.
Yes, right, right. You always have options to rethink it again a little bit next spring.
For sure, for sure. Well, good luck with that, Dave. I know what you're going to be doing this weekend. We are talking with Erin Presley. She is the horticulturist and at Olbrick Botanical Gardens in Madison, where she cares for the herb, wildflower, and pond gardens. What gardening questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up in the last half hour of the show, we'll talk about the importance of seed saving around the world with author Adam Alexander. Definitely want to stick around for that. He's got some really interesting info for you. But right now, let's go back to the phones. We got Twinkie from Stevens Point. Hey, Twinkie, what's up?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have an enclosed garden against the deer, and when my father bought me 4 apple tree whips, I planted them inside the garden against the deer devouring everything, and have done them the espalier, or however it's pronounced, way. And the trees have produced some apples, but I've never quite figured out how I need to keep them pruned or when. I've looked on YouTube and seen things, tried that, and I don't know if I'm cutting off next year's apples. So do you know anything about caring for espalier trees to get the maximum apple production? And when and how to do it?
Right. So this is actually an issue that I have looked into, and I am not by any means an expert on fruit trees, but I do care for an espalier set of pears at Olbrick Gardens, which thankfully was established prior to me inheriting those trees. And so I know that I do for the pears, and as well as I think for the apples, are both the fruit is born on spurs, which is basically like a little cluster of buds that are all sort of growing together. And so, you know, identifying those spurs is really important versus the vegetative, kind of the long sort of whippy growth that doesn't have those little clusters of spurs on it. Definitely do that type of pruning in the late winter once, you know, let all of the leaves fall off, and then wait until doing that sort of pruning later in the season, like February, March. And then beyond that, I really can't tell you, especially in the early stages of establishing the scaffold branches and the shaping and everything like that, I really can't speak to that. I wonder if through UW Extension you could reach out to like a, you know, a fruit specialist who could point you towards a fact sheet or give you a good website resource or something, because, you know, there's people in the art of espalier as it was developed in Europe and everything is, you know.
Yeah, and it's beautiful.
Hundreds and thousands of years old, and it's going to be hard to pick up from a 3-minute YouTube tutorial.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's definitely. But in case you didn't know, that is basically your tree is up against a wall, and so it's flat-ish. Does that make that easy description of
the
it?
It's a lot of manipulation of kind of the natural growth of the tree.
Yeah, and it's beautiful once you get them established, I think. Didn't they do that a lot in colonial times in the U.S. I thought I've seen those in Washington's garden or something.
Yeah, a lot of older, I think also if you're able to grow up against a wall or something like that, you can kind of push your zone a little bit so you can grow fruit more successfully and expect things to ripen a little bit faster and kind of gain the benefit of the wall as a insulation. So I think, you know, maybe in the colonial area, kind of that novelty, too, of being able to experiment, or if you're a wealthy person, have something that was a little bit beyond what you could normally have in a less protected area.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing that up, Twinkie. I always like talking about different stuff. That's always fun. So let's get to that, to the guest from the Herb Fair real quick before we take any more calls. So we've got the first one at 10:30.
Right. So there is a great speaker lineup, and we're going to have at 10:30 Lauren Vernoche of Ecotone Herbs kicking off the speaker lineup talking about wild fermented beverages. And so she farms and forages. Ecotone Herbs is active in the lower Wisconsin River Valley through the Fox River Valley into Illinois. And so a lot of Lauren's practices really focus on building both internal health and resilience, and then how we can use our herbal practices and, you know, the ways that we grow and farm to give back to the communities around us. And so a lot of these, I really know very little about wild fermented beverages, but basically the idea is that if you're foraging or farming outdoors, a lot of our produce has on it a lot of beneficial microorganisms and yeasts. And so if you're able to, through your processing, maintain the integrity of those yeasts and use them basically to kickstart a fermentation process, there's a lot of health benefits that come along with those wild fermented beverages and really unique flavors that kind of develop through the fermentation process. So that one for me, wild fermented beverages, just sounds like, I mean, exactly that, wild and kind of experimental and really, you know, harnessing the power of what nature is already providing to find something that's going to be healthy for, healthy for us.
Okay, and let's take a phone call. We've got two more people to talk about, so we'll try to get to them before we take a break for news, but otherwise they'll come on back. Jeff in Berry Mills, go right ahead with your question.
Yeah, talking about the apple production reminded me of a guy I used to listen to on the radio, Jerry Baker, I think it was, who would say if you went out in the winter, maybe during the winter, and slap your trees with a rubber hose or a newspaper, it makes the tree think that it's dying and it will produce more blossoms, hence more apples. You know, I never tried it, but it always just kind of gave me a chuckle, too.
Thank you, Jeff. We've had a couple of people call in with this tip, and Larry was aware of it, too. So I don't know, have you heard of it at all?
I have not heard of that, and I just would love to see the looks of people who are visiting the public garden in the winter and be like, what are you doing out here? You know, there are a lot of plants, though, where that kind of a little bit of a shock or, you know, some degree of duress, I guess, kind of does spur them to think, like it's go time. I got to set some seed or get some buds out or whatever so sure. I can reproduce. So it's not outside the realm of possibility, I guess.
You look at, I believe when like acorns in the this year has produced tons of acorns because last year was stressful for them is what I've heard over the years. So
yeah, there's definitely something to, you know, those rhythms sort of feeding into each other.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Gianni. Hi, Gianni. He's in Montello. Go right ahead.
Yes. My question concerns the late winter, early spring topical cultivation of asparagus, you know, to get some manure in there and loosen up the soil. How deep should I go for that? And is that even recommended?
I know that, you know, for asparagus, asparagus is a heavy feeding plant. So having some sort of like, I think they normally recommended like a compost sort of an aged manure that isn't quite as, has like the nitrogen quite as hot, I guess, in there to not, you know, be burning your plants in the spring. You would really have to, I have a very small little asparagus patch at my work. I would think you're not going to be cultivating it in too far down because the asparagus crowns are, you know, they have a very dense network growing in the soil, and you really don't want to you don't want to damage the crowns at all. So the extent that you're working that in, you might almost be kind of mounding it on top and then putting, you know, some other sort of mulch to kind of just settle that all down. That's what I personally would do. But you might want to do some more. I would maybe consult, you know, a grower's guide for asparagus, either through UW Extension or a good, you know, Johnny's Select Seeds or, you know, a good grower resource. That'll give you a little bit more detail there.
Okay. Good luck, Gianni. Once you get it established, it's great. You have that fresh asparagus. Let's go back to our guests at the Herbal Fair. Who do we have at 12:30?
And that is Linda Conroy of Moonwise Herbs. And Linda is so active in the herbal culture, you know, right around the Madison area and really throughout the state and beyond. So she has a great company, Moonwise Herbs, and she does also a lot in the realm of education. So you see Linda around, see her name and classes and things she's offering everywhere. She's really a great educator and community resource. And she is going to be talking about incorporating mushrooms into your daily life for flavor and wellness. So she's going to be covering both sourcing and cooking with mushrooms, healing properties of mushrooms, and how to prepare them for medicine, including for topical applications. So Linda is just a wealth of knowledge, and she is one of those people who knows, you know, she's like an encyclopedia. So I think, you know, her talk on mushrooms in the kitchen and apothecary is going to be great.
Because the properties of mushroom being helpful healing-wise has really started to take off. I can't believe how much I see out there with mushrooms involved.
Yeah, there's... you know, I am no expert on mushrooms, but one of the mushrooms that I incorporate into my, really my daily diet is the reishi mushroom. And so this is a mushroom that, you know, people find the health benefits of today, but it historically in China in the dynastic times was reserved only for the family of the Chinese emperors.
Whoa.
And because it was considered to be such a revered plant and had such powerful healing properties that it was actually illegal for kind of the everyday people to be able to have access to it. And here in the modern era, I can just go down to my local community pharmacy and get sliced up reishi mushroom and have it, you know, anytime I make a batch of beans or a soup or anything
that,
I throw the reishi mushroom in there.
I love it.
So it's really neat how a lot of these things too do double as, you know, the heart of what an herb is it's food and medicine.
Well, and on that note, next week on the show, we're going to talk to Sean, and I can't remember his last name off the top of my head. But he'll be with us to talk about growing mushrooms from Venturian Farms. He's been with us before, but now we're going to focus in on mushrooms. So make sure that you tune in again tomorrow. In the meantime, we're going to take a little break for news, but come on back. Aaron's staying with us. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nadeau. Erin Presley is back with us. She is a horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, and she cares for the herb, wildflower, and pond gardens. And Erin's gardening interest includes native woodland gardening, low maintenance and sustainable gardens, and anything having to do with growing, cooking, and eating your own herbs and veggies. What gardening questions do you have for her? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And again, we're talking a little bit about the herb fair that's going to be happening at Olbrich next Saturday, right? 10 to 4. So, November 1st, 10 to 4 at Olbrich. And there are some lovely speakers. We talked about two of them last hour. One more to go. And this is the garlic guy.
The garlic guy, yes. So Terry Aiken will be telling us all about growing and using garlic, as well as history, culture, and science of garlic. And Terry is actually a recently retired pharmaceutical chemist. So actually has that science to back up, you know, his knowledge of garlic and be able to really kind of get into the nuts and bolts of, you know, what makes it so good for us and why we love it so much.
That's right. That's right. And if you want, a couple weeks ago, we talked to Patty Nagai here, and she gave us a how-to with growing garlic. So if you're interested in growing it yourself, you can definitely listen to that. And I believe we've got a story for WPR.org coming out too on growing garlic. So it's really interesting, and it's so good for us too, isn't it?
Yeah, and garlic has got to be, you know, if there's one thing that is a really low barrier to planting and harvesting and getting into, you know, saving and growing your own garlic, It's really a piece of cake. It's kind of one of those things hopefully anybody could do without too much space or too much hassle, and just really, really rewarding.
Yeah, that was her take on it too. She says, it's the easiest thing you can ever grow. So try it. Even in like planters inside, which I thought was interesting. What the heck? Give it a try, right? So, so if we've got open lines, if anybody has a question, 800-642-1234. And email, of course, that's talk@wpr.org. And Aaron in Hartford emailed us. He has black plastic over a large area of his yard, roughly 25 by 75 foot. It's been there all summer. And he's wondering if it's too late to plant native flower seeds, because he's heard that the best time to plant is in the fall, but he's not sure how late is too late. And secondly, do you recommend any places to get the seeds from?
Okay. Well, congratulations for reducing your monoculture of lawn out there. So it is true that many of our native wildflowers and grasses do really well with a fall or even like an early winter sowing. So you're on the right track there. The fact that you did the killing off of the lawn with the black plastic over the summer, that's also a great start. Since this is a relatively large area, you know, 25 by 75, it's a bit of an investment of your time and, you know, looking at seed and stuff already. So I would double check basically your practices up to this point with a great book that was published by Neil DeBoll, who is really one of the vanguard founders of gardening with native plants in the Midwest and beyond. So Neil, his nursery is based in Westfield, Wisconsin, but he published an amazing book, and it's called The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. And Neil goes through, if you're establishing a native plant garden, you know, all of the steps to get it done the right way. So what I would do is I'd pick up this book and just double check that your length of your solarization has been long enough to actually kill off your grass or whatever else you had growing in there. Assuming that, you know, obviously lifting that up and doing some digging around and testing before you invest in the seed is going to be good. And then I would follow the book's recommendations as far as sourcing a seed mix that could be tailored to your particular area. But I would really, before you go into this pretty serious investiture, I would just pick up Neil's book, The Gardener's Guide to Gardening with Prairie Plants, and then make sure that you're on the right track, which it sounds like you are. And you're, asking about the timing of, it's definitely not too late. And if anything, you might benefit from waiting a little bit longer. I know when I've participated in like prairie seeding projects, one of the things that can really be helpful for timing is picking a day that has like a light dusting of snow, because then when you're going out there and you're spreading your seeds, you can actually see the seeds against that little dusting of snow, and it helps you understand whether you're sowing your seed in a consistent pattern. And usually that can be done throughout most of the winter. As long as we don't have a real thick snow cover. So you've got plenty of time. I would spend a little bit more time on research before pulling the trigger on this one.
Absolutely. Great advice. The snow tip is excellent. I've never heard that one before. So that's a great idea. And Neil was on with us about a month or so ago. So if you want to go to our website and Aaron, and just Google on the, or just search on the Garden Talk page, his shows will come up. And the last one was about fall seeding. So that will also help you in his words too. So good luck. Let's go back to the phones. Christine in Sauk County, go right ahead with your question.
Hi, I have a chokecherry tree in my front yard, and I'm not sure where to begin for pruning it. It's starting to, it almost looks like it has a neck and a head where it's all got the leaves and then arms, and then it's like got a big kind of gaping hole in the middle. And so I'm trying to decide or how to best prune it to kind of get it to be a little more fuller and fluffier. Any tips?
Right. So the chokecherry, I mean, that is a native tree, and kind of its native structure is just going to be kind of like you described, where it is a little bit on the naturalistic or sort of the gangly side. Yeah. And then additionally, a lot of those smaller scale native cherries, whether it's wild plum or chokecherry, they're not extraordinarily long-lived trees. So you might also be seeing or feeling like it's kind of thin just because it is mature, or maybe even approaching, you know, kind of the end of its life, if it is in that, you know, 15 plus years old, I guess. I think a lot of those smaller native cherries maybe live up to 25 or 30 years or something, and not super long lived. You could experiment just with, like, you know, very casually at first, just pruning back some of the outer branches just a little bit, just to kind of experiment and see if next year you do see increased growth from those spots. But basically with any type of tree, whether it's a fruiting tree or a tree that you're pruning for shape really in any way, just be very careful if you don't know what you're doing. You're only going to want to be removing like a minimal amount of tissue at any one time. So I would just experiment with it just a little bit at first, and then see where that new growth sprouts out from your pruning cuts. But I would really avoid doing anything too drastic, because at the end of the day, kind of this loose and open form is really what the chokecherry, what it wants to be. And it's a native tree, and that's just sort of what, you know, what it wants to do.
Yeah, I like that. What it likes, wants to be. So go zen, Christine. Let it be what it wants to be. Thank you for the call. Brooke in Eau Claire, go right ahead with your question.
Hi. This spring I bought a miniature yellow canna, and it got like 4 feet tall. It wasn't really that miniature. Beautiful. I dug it up yesterday, and it has, it's a huge clump, and because there was, it sent up several stalks, that one clump. Should I be dividing that now or wait till next spring or what? The clumps, I mean.
This is a really, very timely question. I know my mom was texting me yesterday, and she was doing the exact same thing, digging up and storing her canna lilies. So you could, I think that your best bet is going to be to divide in the spring. If you're able to manage the clump that you have right now, just physically, like if you're able to keep it in one clump, and then I'm assuming that you know about, you know, have a game plan for how you're going to overwinter it in a dry, cool place over the winter. Sometimes if we try to do our division of those kind of tuberous plants in the fall, if you make like a fresh cut or you accidentally, you know, break it, this would be like with dahlias or something like that too, having kind of that open wound as it goes into storage can be a good way to introduce like rot or disease. So that division part of it, you're probably going to be best off doing that in the springtime when you're preparing for planting versus right now.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question, Brooke. Very timely. I'm a lazy gardener. I'd never plant bulbs that have to be dug up. I'm terrible. But they're so beautiful. Cannas are gorgeous.
There are really some of the advanced, like the breeding technology in canna in the last couple of years, and some of just the delightful soft colors.
Yes.
And really, and there are some, I mean, I know you said yours was supposed to be dwarf and it was still 4 feet tall, but there are some varieties that do legitimately stay more in the, you know, 3-foot-ish range, mm-hmm. which is nice maybe compared to some of the others that get to be 6 feet tall. So
yeah. Oh, I haven't seen a 6-foot one. That's wonderful. I like that idea. Margaret emailed us and she is asking if there is a market for black walnuts. She apparently has a plethora of them.
A market for black walnuts. I know here at the farmers market in Madison, I can only think of one vendor that does sell shelled black walnuts. And they are, you know, it's quite a high value little jar of walnuts that you're buying by the time they've gone through all the work of shelling them for you. So I don't know that, you know, unless you're really willing to go through the effort of processing them to that extent that they really have much value. I know a good friend of mine uses walnuts, I think when they're in the greener stage, actually to make like a walnut liqueur.
Ooh.
Which is really tasty and has kind of that pungent sort of that, you know, that green walnut or that like black walnut smell.
Yeah.
In like a liqueur form. So that would be maybe something you could consider, would be kind of a value added, I guess, product. But as far as what to do with the walnuts, I don't know if there's any, you know, sorts of farms that could use those that as animal feed.
You know, there's a shell, there's an outer shell, there's a mess in between.
I don't really have much of an answer for that one, unfortunately. Yeah.
And they can be used as dye, too.
Yeah, yes, that's another.
Want to get into that.
One other good way to use what I'm sure is only a small, small percentage of the, you know, many that you probably have if you have a big tree.
Yeah, if anybody has any ideas, let us know.
We'd love to hear it.
For sure. 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to italk@wpr.org. Bonnie emailed us, and she was wondering, how can you grow sweet grass in southeastern Wisconsin?
All right, so sweetgrass, Hierochloe odorata, is a rhizomatous grass, native grass, that is highly prized in First Nations cultures. So I know, like, amongst the Ho-Chunk Nation people, they have 4 sacred herbs, and it's sage, cedar, tobacco, and sweetgrass. So one thing that you're going to be really wanting to think about is ethically sourcing your plants and make sure they come from someone who is reputable. If you can actually find an indigenous vendor, you know, you have kind of some extra good intention, I think, going into those plants. We at Olbrich Gardens have a large patch of sweetgrass that has been there for many years, and it kind of grows on the upper edges of our rain garden. The sweetgrass is rhizomatous, and it is a very sturdy grower. So wherever you put it, I think a lot of people who grow sweetgrass commercially actually grow it in contained beds, because it is one of those plants that will kind of grow and grow and grow until it runs up against something that it really can't grow into. Mm-hmm. So consider growing it in a contained area, you know, even if it's between the side of your house and a sidewalk or raised bed type situation, something like that. And then it is a cool season grass, so it actually sprouts early in the spring and does most of its growing when the weather is cool, as opposed to a lot of your, you know, other ornamental grasses that are at their best during later in the summer. And then, so those are, and it does, it is a kind of a moisture loving grass. So compared to some other grasses, it's going to want a little bit more water than mm-hmm. a lot of other ornamental grasses. And then the sweetgrass typically is harvested if you're wanting to do, you know, braids or something like that. Again, always like approaching those plants with the utmost respect is really important. And, so you could find some, you know, guides, I think, about, but the harvest timing is usually around May to June, and then you dry the sweetgrass and then sort of re-wet it when you're able to, wanting to start working with it.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for that question. Thank you for that answer. I haven't heard all that information before, so that was
yeah.
great. Oh, we've got Linda in Middleton with a comment about black walnuts. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, good morning. Several years ago at the Wisconsin Sheep and Wool Festival, I bought some wonderful buttons that were made of sliced black walnut shells. They're lovely. They work so well with with wool sweaters and things like that. I have no clue as to how to cut them properly, but it might be something to play around with.
Okay. Thank you, Linda.
Okay.
Bye-bye. I've seen those. They're a slice of the walnut. In fact, I think I got some in an estate sale somewhere in a bag of whatever. But yeah, they're kind of a neat look. These were buttons that I had, so that was kind of interesting. So there you go. Another idea. Thank you, Linda. Let's go to Vicki in Eau Claire next. Hi, Vicki. Vicki, are you there?
Oh. Hello?
Oh, hello? Yep, go right ahead.
Okay. Hi. Years ago, my father used to go out in the woods and bring home ground cherries. And then through the years, I'm 75, they'd be a garnish on a dinner plate or whatever. Anyway, so I got seeds this spring. I started them in a little pot, and they're now in an 8-inch pot, and they're in my laundry room. And the plants are growing, and the cherries are, the husks aren't brown yet. They'll drop off when they're brown. Can I winter them in my laundry room, and should I put them in a bigger pot? I'm just wondering if this is something I can do.
Wow, I never thought about growing them inside.
Me neither. I mean, I guess it's worth a try if you've had success up to this point. Don't rock the boat. I would not recommend putting them in a larger pot, because I think at this stage in the game, with winter coming on, you know, even if you're growing things in your home, there still are a lot of factors that do have some seasonality. So you are having reduced light from the outside, probably as your heat kicks on, you know, variations in temperature and stuff. So I think I wouldn't put them in a new pot, because it seems unlikely the plant's going to be able to kind of ride out all of those different changes. But if you're, you know, hoping that they'll get ripe and you've had success so far, I would just keep an eye on them and hope that you get some ripe ones in there. And
that
then maybe
great.
Next year is the year to start with further experimentation
right.
With new plants. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if they're native, right? They're a native plant. Do they need to go through cold?
There are some types
okay.
of ground cherries that I think are native plants in
okay.
the genus Physalis.
Mm-hmm.
If you bought seeds of them, though, those I'm thinking are not a native plant. Mm-hmm. Like anything that would be a cultivated variety is probably, I associate those more with like almost like Mexican type cuisine and more like a tomatillo.
Yeah.
So I don't think that they would need like a cold spell or anything mm-hmm. to do their thing, but report back.
I definitely. Thank you, Vicky. That's a really cool experiment. That's kind of what we have to do as gardeners, don't we? Just experiment to see what works.
There's never a dull moment out there.
There never is. So real quick in the last couple of minutes here, Erin, let's go through the upcoming herb fair that's happening next week.
Great. So on Saturday, November 1st, so that's just a little over a week away, the Madison Herb Society will be hosting their annual herb fair. And this is at Ulbrich Botanical Gardens, which is in Madison. We're at 3330 Atwood Ave. And the herb fair is a free public event. It runs from 10 to 4. There is a lineup of three amazing speakers that are all regionally based. So, the sessions are free. And then the Herb Society has arranged a wonderful list of vendors who will be selling great herbal stuff. It's the best smelling day of the year at Ulbrich Gardens. So please come on down and, fill up your pantry and your kitchen shelves. And if you have also any questions about herbs, there's a wealth of knowledge in the people who are, staffing all of the booths, vending. So really any question that you did not have the opportunity to ask today, bring it down to the herb fair on November 1st.
There you go. And three great guest speakers on fermenting. What was the second one?
Mushrooms in the kitchen and apothecary. And cultivation, cooking, culture, and science of garlic.
There you go. What a great day that sounds like. So, well, Erin, thank you once again for coming in and sharing your vast knowledge with us and for the little treats of the food and the tea. I appreciate that. So hopefully we'll get you back here again soon.
It's always a pleasure, Jill.
You bet. Our guest today has been Erin Presley. She is a horticulturist at Ulbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Up next, we're going to talk about why seed savers around the world are heroes. What questions do you have about the importance of saving seeds from your garden? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, if you enjoy growing different varieties and you save your seeds from year to year, our next guest may describe you as a seed hero. This is Garden Talk, and I'm Jill Nadeau. Our guest is Adam Alexander. He is an author, film and television producer with a passion for collecting rare, endangered, and delicious vegetables from around the world. His first book you may have heard of is called The Seed Detective, and it was shortlisted for the Garden Media Guild's Garden Book of the Year in 2023. And his latest is another good one. It's called The Accidental Seed Heroes, Growing a Delicious Food Future for All of Us. Are you a seed saver? Why do you think it's important? What questions do you have about seed saving and its importance to you? Join in calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, hello, Jill, and thank you so much for asking me onto your show. I'm absolutely thrilled.
Well, I am thrilled to talk with you because your first book was really so interesting, and this one is too. You must really enjoy doing the research for these books.
I certainly do. I get to travel a bit, but most importantly, I get to meet amazing growers and eat delicious food. I mean, what's not to like about that?
Yeah. Do you have another person? Do you have a job opening for me? Because I think I could get into that. So I talked a little bit about the Seed Detective book, and that's kind of your moniker these days. How did you even get into that in the first place? Because your background is sort of, you know, film and television.
Well, I mean, actually, I'm a country boy, and a farm boy. My mum was farming until the day she died, age 94. So I've got form, as they say. But I always much preferred growing vegetables than I did farming with livestock. And in fact, I've been doing it ever since I was a kid. But the truth is that it's easier to make a living as a film producer than it is, or it was, than it was as a vegetable grower. And I never had the nerve to, I mean, I did it for a bit, but it was not for me. However, my work, I mean, the great thing about being a producer was my job was to get everybody else to do the work. And the other thing is that the last thing anybody wants on a set is the producer hanging around. So it was great. I could just go off and indulge my curiosity and interest in uncovering rare and endangered varieties of vegetables that were of cultural and social importance, and also delicious. And it really kicked off for me in, of all places, Donetsk in the Ukraine, which of course is on the front line of a terrible war at the moment. And I was making a TV series there, and my director was a vegetarian, and this is in the dying days of the Soviet Union in the late 80s. And trying to feed a vegetarian in the USSR in those days was not easy, but you could find good quality fresh produce in the local market. And it was there that I met somebody who was to become a sort of archetype for me, this babushka, this little old lady. And she was selling fruits and vegetables that she was growing in her backyard. And amongst all these things was a pepper. And the pepper, the sweet pepper, is a very important part of the food culture, not only of many countries of what was then the USSR, but the whole of Eastern and Central Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean. And so I guess there are as many recipes for stuffed peppers in that part of the world as there are chefs and babushkas making them.
Sure.
And on her stall, she had these peppers, and they were sort of about the size of a tennis ball, deep red, multi-lobed. And I thought, well, I think, you know, Colin might like these. But I was not a huge sweet pepper fan, not because I didn't like eating them, but because in general, I find them so disappointing. I'd been buying seed, you know, in the normal way from commercial seed companies, and they were okay. Anyway, I took these peppers back to the hotel where we were staying, and I thought I really should try this. And I sliced one in half and took a bite. And it was, for me, the first of a wow moment. It was a wow, what is this? And I tell you, I've had many since then. But this pepper is thick-fleshed and fruity and sweet, but it has a lovely complexity of flavour and a lovely little bit of heat at the end, just to let you know it's there. And I thought, this is fantastic. Fortunately, my director loved his peppers. And I thought, I wonder what happens if I take some of these seeds back home with me and see if I can grow them. And I did, and I've been growing it ever since. And it really was started me on this sort of quest to track down crops that really matter to other people, but which I could grow in my own vegetable garden, and which were above all else delicious. And I could save the seeds and share those seeds. And now, I don't know, I have a library of 550 varieties, and it takes up a lot of my time.
Yes, I saw that on your website. And if anybody wants to check that out, it's the seeddetective.com, is that right?
No, seeddetective.co.uk.
Oh, that's right. www.co.co.uk. So what are the characteristics that you look for in a good variety?
What I'm interested in, first of all, is its provenance. I want to know where it comes from and why it matters to the grower and the eater. What's so great about that pea that you think is good, or the bean, or the tomato, or whatever the crop is? And then what I'm looking for is, I'm looking at something that is highly heterogeneous and genetically diverse. So traditional crops, not exclusively, because one of the things that's so exciting about what's happening today is that you have this amazing new generation of freelance and independent plant breeders who are really trying to restore genetic diversity. So I'm looking for the crops that actually are part of the solution to building a sustainable and resilient future to our food.
Mm-hmm. And that was kind of one of your quests that you were looking for, were people who were actually doing this in different areas of the world. Before we even go there, you know, you talked about the science. So many people hear that when it's, oh no, we don't want any genetically modified anything. But you have a little bit more of a in-between opinion on that. So why don't you share that?
Well, indeed. I think the first thing is to just remind ourselves that up until a couple of hundred years ago, farmers were the plant breeders. We didn't have women and men in white coats in laboratories doing fancy genetic work with plants. In fact, that only really started about 100 years ago. And these farmers were basically selecting from the traits of the descendants of the wild parents that they had domesticated thousands of years ago. And through this process of selection, we ended up with an incredible diversity of crops. You know, that pepper that I might from Donetsk is what is known as a landrace or farmer's variety. It wasn't deliberately bred. It was the result of selection over many, many generations and probably hundreds of years. And then what happened was we had this incredible explosion in systematic plant breeding that really started early on in the 1800s, and it wasn't just farmers, but all sorts of growers, both amateur and professional, started to ask themselves the question, what happens if I cross this variety with that variety? What am I going to get? And that really was the start of what we call systematic, but traditional plant breeding. And that was incredibly exciting. And if you look at the history of plant breeding, particularly in the 19th century, it was full of passionate, enthusiastic amateurs and professionals who were just following their own whims and interests and curiosities to develop new varieties, and also to breed crops that really thrived where they came from. And then what happened was Mendel came along, Gregor Mendel, who was the man who really did the work on starting understanding what hereditary was all about. And he did it with peas right at the late back end of the 19th century. But it was only early in the 20th century that people really took notice of his incredible work. And out of that was invented the word genetics. And that's what we think of today as being at the heart of modern plant breeding. And I find it endlessly fascinating and curious. I think it's amazing what work is being done with plant genetics and with what we call molecular breeding, which is also breeding hybrids. You know, we've heard of F1 hybrids. This is all, again, precursors to what we think of now as genetically modified organisms, GMOs. But to me, the problem with modern plant breeding is not that it actually hasn't done had some incredible achievements. Let's not forget that 100 years ago, there were 2 billion people living on the planet. Today, there are 8 billion. And that's because we're able to feed ourselves. And we're able to feed ourselves because of these incredible advances in these very high yielding crops that we've been growing all over the world, but particularly the key crops, which are wheat, rice, maize, soya. And what that has done is it may have fed us, but we've paid a terrible price, which is that we have lost the genetic diversity that we were so blessed with as little a time ago as, you know, the 1920s and 30s. And what we have to do is we have to ask ourselves the question, what do we want the future of our food to be? Do you want it to be homogenous, genetically narrow, commodified crops that are monocultures? Or do we want to restore diversity and deliciousness into our food and grow and eat the things that mean something to us culturally and socially, mm-hmm. as well as things that thrive wherever we live in the world?
Right. And that, and you definitely talk about that a lot in your book. And we'll talk a little bit more in just a bit. Adam Alexander is our guest today. He is author of the important gardening book, The Seed Detective, and his latest is called The Accidental Seed Heroes, Growing a Delicious Food Future for All of Us. If you've got a question for Adam, give us a call. It's 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send us an email. That's talk@WPR.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again on Monday. We're going to start out Halloween week by talking with gothic suspense author Wendy Webb. We're also going to look at the myths surrounding the fires and murders at Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin. And finally, the weather guys are back, and they're going to talk about what makes spooky weather. So I hope you can join Larry on Monday starting at 11. Right now, we are talking about seed saving and the importance of it around the world. Adam, you were just talking before we broke about monoculture, basically growing the same exact thing, only one kind of corn or one kind of soybean or what have you. What is the evil in that?
Well, if your pensions advisor was to say to you, Jill, I've got this great stock, put all your money in that, mm-hmm. and you'll be rich and you'll live a nice life as an old lady, you'd say, you've got to be crazy. I need to diversify.
Right.
And why is it that it seems to make sense that we diversify our investments in our future with our money, but we don't do the same thing with our food, which actually is kind of, without food, we're not going to be around to enjoy our pensions anyway.
There you go.
the real problem with monoculture is that, yes, it's had some incredible successes, and I don't damn it for that at all. The problem is that monocultures are systems that are really built around the commodification of food. That creates real problems if you're a farmer, because as a farmer you then become essentially locked into a vertically integrated system of producing food, which actually removes you from the end user. You know, the happy farmers I know are those ones that you see at the farmers market who know who their customers are and know what it is they like to eat. And so this is why what I call diversity or heterogeneity is so incredibly important. And the other thing is, when you have a monoculture, you know, every head of that maize, every ear of wheat is identical to the one next to it. And you don't need much to get in the way of that, a pathogen, some sort of disease, something that happens with the weather, and you can compromise the whole crop. And we see that more and more happening, you know, in Europe, in the US, around the world. And we have to build resilience into our food systems, which is why having a greater diversity of crops, actually in the same way as it is with our investments, helps smooth out the peaks and troughs and ensures that we've got something to eat at the end of the day.
And, you know, that makes such sense, but I don't think that we've thought about that in that way before. So it is really nice to think about the possibilities. So getting back to the world of seed savers, so who are some of these heroes and how did you pick them out?
The first primary seed heroes are those native and indigenous farmers and traditional farmers who are maintaining what are known as land races or farmers' varieties, traditional varieties of crops that are locally adapted and which have come about as the result of selection and continual selection that's been going on for generations. They are what really custodians of what we know as evolutionary plant breeding, where you essentially allow Mother Nature to be the plant breeder and you select from your crops the best seeds to use the following year. And so I've met wonderful farmers in Ethiopia, a country that you think of as being, you know, in a terrible mess with drought and suffering, and there is drought and suffering, but it's also a country where there are these wonderful farmers who practice agroforestry. They grow all their crops together in one field. There are some parts of southern Ethiopia that I've been to where they haven't experienced a famine for 800 years. And that's because they are building resilience into the way they think about growing. So their mindset is, I don't know whether I'm going to get rains next year, if they're going to be too early, too late, too much, too little. They don't think about climate change in the way that we do in the global north. They just think, my goodness me, how am I going to be sure I've got something to put on the table at the end of the year? So they will mix their crops and grow them together. And I love to see that in people's gardens. Don't grow just one type of pole bean. Grow 10. And grow them all together in the same plot. You won't be disappointed. And you save the seeds, which is what these guys are doing. And you then yourself become a seed hero, because what you're doing by saving these seeds and growing them year after year and again, the seeds become familiar. They wake up in the spring and they think, oh, I know where I am. I'm at home. And also, because they're very heterogeneous, these traditional types of, you know, what we call heirlooms and heritage varieties. They have these very broad, diverse genomes. Their genetics are huge. And that gives what I call flex. So within their genome are memories. They've been around for so long that the fact that it's hot one year and wet the next doesn't really come as a surprise. It might be a challenge for them to be able to grow in certain extreme environments, but actually they have this fantastic ability to exploit the part of their genome that best ensures they're going to be able to grow mature fruit and have progeny for following years.
And with this climate change that we're all experiencing, that is a big part of it too. So if you're in a region where it's slowly warming up, if you keep collecting those seeds year after year, they're going to be more acclimated to that, right?
Absolutely. It's like, you know, you think of my pepper. I've been growing that for 35 years on and off. I've probably grown it 25 times. You know, until 10 years ago, I couldn't grow a sweet pepper outside in my wet, cool corner of South Wales. I can grow that pepper now. And here we are. Look, we're nearly at the end of October. I'm still harvesting beautiful red sweet peppers out of my garden. And that's because of how I've selected seeds from early fruits, from the most delicious ones, the ones that have the shape that I like and the colour. And the more all of us do that, the better the chances we are giving ourselves that we're going to actually be getting crops out of our gardens, regardless of what the weather does.
Mm-hmm. And you were in Ethiopia also. The indigenous grain, teff.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so tell us about that. And I was looking at a recipe. Oh, this sounds really good. I need to make this in Jura. Yeah, no.
Injera. It's injera, for those who don't know, it's like a sort of pancake, flatbread, and you eat it with everything. It's sort of in India you'd call it a chapati, but it's thinner and flatter than that. Teff is a really interesting cereal. So it's indigenous to Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa. Actually it comes in two colours, white and red. The Ethiopians prefer the white one to the red one, but actually the red one is probably even more nutritious than the white one. It's a very high value grain because it's not a big, it doesn't yield very much, particularly. It grows in a huge diversity of regions. So at altitude, and it'll grow in the hottest places and the coolest and the wettest and the driest. So it's very resilient. Ethiopians eat injera every day. The injera is not always 100% teff. It'll often have other things in it, like sorghum, which is another crop that is indigenous to that part of Africa. I mean, it's probably the fourth or fifth most important cereal in the world. But there are some really interesting things are happening with bringing together traditional farmers. And this is the other aspect of being a seed hero, is you have these traditional farmers who are growing injera, and it's a very important part of their income. But it's difficult, it's challenging. They don't get really good yields all the time. So they are now collaborating with plant scientists from all sorts of august institutions, Cornell in the US, the Kew in the UK, and other bodies, to collaborate, to be part of a participatory program between the farmer, the modern plant breeder, the geneticist, to kind of figure out what is it that works for the grower. What is it that you're really looking for that is going to help you to improve your crops? And I find, and this is happening not just with teff, which is an incredibly important crop and could be really important for many of us around the world as the climate changes, but it's also happening with lots and lots of others of what we call these underutilized or orphan crops that are not part of mainstream food culture around the world, but actually are in vital parts of how we build resilience into our food systems with climate change.
In the epilogue of your book, you talked about what might be going on in 2050 and how you're optimistic about that. I think sometimes we need a little shot of optimism. In the next couple of minutes that we have left here, why don't you tell us what are you optimistic about and what are you seeing in this area?
I'm really optimistic because when I think about farming and growing vegetables and the genetics of the people involved in it, certainly in my world, lots of old farmers, and it's very traditional and conservative. What I've been seeing in the last few years is this incredible injection of fresh talent, blood, genes of a younger demographic group of people. Many of them have had nothing to do with growing food, but they bring with them a host of other skills and outlooks. They're very savvy, they're far more entrepreneurial, and they also recognize that it's down to them to actually really solve these fundamental existential issues. And I'm hugely inspired by them. I mean, I was just at a conference the other day, hundreds of young people with their new farms, with their small holdings, their plant breeders, they're developing new varieties, they're collaborating and networking. And that gives me huge hope for the future. And also, it's an inexorable path. 50 years ago, when I was trying to grow organic vegetables and sell them in the market in Devon, people thought I was crazy, and I probably was. I don't want to go back to those days. Now, I look at where the opportunities and potential are, and that there is actually a huge demographic out there who are really hungry for change and want better food and want to know more about it and where it comes from, and then also to grow it themselves.
Well, thank you for those wonderfully optimistic words. I really appreciate it. It's been a joy to talk with you, Adam. I hope we can do it again.
So do I. Thank you so much for inviting me. Bye.
Thank you. We've been talking to Adam Alexander. He is the author of the new book, The Accidental Seed Heroes, Growing a Delicious Food Future for All of Us. And you really need to check it out. And thank you all for joining us today. I want to thank the team, Claire Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, and of course, Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us again on Monday. Have a good one.